Chapter 2. Questions of Leadership. Thunder rumbled above, soft and menacing like the growl of a distant beast. Perrin turned his eyes toward the sky. A few days ago, the pervasive cloud cover had turned black, darkening like the advent of a horrible storm. But rain had come only in spurts. Another rumble shook the air. There was no lightning. Perrin patted Steyr on the neck. The horse smelled skittish, prickly, sweaty. The horse wasn't the only one. That scent hung above his enormous force of troops and refugees as they tramped across the muddy ground. That force created a thunder of its own. Footsteps, hoofbeats, wagon wheels turning, men and women calling. They had nearly reached the Johanna Road. Originally, Perrin had planned to cross that and continue on northward, toward Andor. But he'd lost a great deal of time to the sickness that had struck his camp. Both Ashaman had nearly died. Then this thick mud had slowed them even further. All told, it had been over a month since they'd left Maldon, and they'd traveled only as far as Perrin had originally hoped to go in a week. Perrin put his hand into his coat pocket, feeling at the small blacksmith's puzzle there. They'd found it in Maldon, and he'd taken to fiddling with it. So far, he hadn't figured out how to get the pieces apart. It was as complex a puzzle as he'd ever seen. There was no sign of Master Gil or the people Perrin had sent on ahead with supplies. Grady had managed a few small gateways ahead to send scouts to find them, but they had returned without news. Perrin was beginning to worry about them.
"My lord?"
a man asked. He stood beside Perrin's horse. Turn was a lanky fellow with curly red hair and a beard he tied off with leather cords. He carried a warrior's axe and a loop at his belt, a wicked thing with a spike at the back.
"We can't pay much," Perrin said. "Your men don't have horses?"
"No, my lord,"
Turn said, glancing at his dozen companions.
"Jar had one. We ate it a few weeks back."
Turn smelled unwashed and dirty, and above those scents was an odd staleness. Had the man's emotions gone numb?
"If you don't mind, my lord, wages can wait. If you have food, well, that will be enough for now."
"I should turn them away," Perrin thought. "We already have too many mouths to feed."
Lighty was supposed to be getting rid of people. But these fellows looked handy with their weapons, and if he turned them away, they'd no doubt turn to pillaging.
"Go down the line," Perrin said. "Find a man named Tam Althor. He's a sturdy fellow, dressed like a farmer. Anyone should be able to point you in his direction. Tell him you spoke with Perrin, and I said to take you on for meals."
The dirty men relaxed, and their lanky leader actually smelled grateful. Grateful? Sellswords, maybe bandits, grateful to be taken on only for meals. That was the state of the world.
"Tell me, my lord,"
Turn said as his group began to hike down the line of refugees.
"Do you really have food?"
"We do," Perrin said. "I just said so. And it doesn't spoil after a night left alone?"
"Course it doesn't," Perrin said sternly. "Not if you keep it right."
Some of their grain might have weevils in it, but it was edible. The man seemed to find that incredible, as if Perrin had said his wagons would soon sprout wings and fly off for the mountains.
"Go on now," Perrin said, "and make sure to tell your men that we run a tight camp. No fighting, no stealing. If I get a whiff of you making trouble, you'll be out on your ears."
"Yes, my lord,"
Turn said, then hastened off to join his men. He smelled sincere. Tam wasn't going to be pleased to have another batch of mercenaries to watch over, but the Shido were still out there somewhere. Most of them seemed to have turned eastward. But with how slowly Perrin's force had been traveling, he was worried the Aiel might change their minds and come back for him. He nudged Steyr forward, flanked by a pair of Two Rivers men. Now that Aram was gone, the Two Rivers men had, unfortunately, taken it upon themselves to provide Perrin with bodyguards. Today's annoyances were Will Alcine and Reed Solon. Perrin had tried chewing out the men about it, but they insisted. And he had bigger worries to bother him, not the least of which were his strange dreams, haunting visions of working the forges and being unable to create anything of worth.
"Put them out of your mind," he told himself,
riding up the long column, Alcine and Solon keeping up.
"You have nightmares enough while awake. Deal with those first."
The meadow around him was open, though the grass was yellowing, and he noticed with displeasure several large swaths of dead wildflowers, rotting. The spring rains had turned most areas like this into mud traps. Moving so many refugees was slow, even discounting the bubble of evil in the mud. Everything took longer than he expected, including getting out of Malden. The force kicked up mud as it marched. Most of the refugees' trousers and skirts were covered with it, and the air was thick with its sticky scent. Perrin neared the front of their line, passing riders in red breastplates, lances held high, their helms like rimmed pots. The winged guard of Mayenne. Lord Galen rode at their front, red-plumed helm held at his side. His bearing was formal enough that you might think he was riding in a parade, but his single eye was keen and sharp as he scanned the countryside. He was a good soldier. There were a lot of good soldiers in this force, though sometimes it was tough as bending a horseshoe to keep their hands from one another's throats.
"Lord Perrin,"
a voice shouted. Arganda, first captain of Gildan, pushed through the Mayenner lines, riding a tall roan gelding. His troops rode in a wide column beside the Mayenners. Ever since Aleandra's return, Arganda had been set on equal treatment. He'd complained that the winged guard often rode in front. Rather than spur further arguments, Perrin had ordered their columns to ride side by side.
"Was that another batch of mercenaries?"
Arganda demanded, pulling his horse up beside Perrin.
"A small band," Perrin said. "Probably once the guard of some local city's lord."
"Deserters,"
Arganda spat to the side.
"You should have sent for me. My queen would want them strung up. Don't forget that we're in Gildan now."
"Your queen is my liegewoman,"
Perrin said as they reached the front of the column.
"We're not stringing up anyone unless we have proof of their crimes. Once everyone is safely back where they belong, you can start sorting through the sellswords and see if you can charge any of them. Until then, they're just hungry men looking for someone to follow."
Arganda smelled frustrated. Perrin had gained a few weeks of goodwill from him and Galen following the successful assault on Malden, but old divisions were resurfacing in the near impassable mud under a sky full of tumbling thunderheads.
"Don't worry yourself," Perrin said. "I have men watching over the newcomers."
He also had them watching the refugees. Some were so docile that they would hardly go to the privy without being instructed to do so. Others kept looking over their shoulders, as if expecting Shido to spring from the distant line of oaks and sweet gum trees at any moment. People who smelled that terrified could be trouble, and the various factions of his camp already walked as if trudging through itchweed.
"You may send someone to talk to the newcomers, Arganda," Perrin said. "Talk only. Find out where they're from, learn whether they did serve a lord, see if they can add anything to the maps."
They didn't have any good maps of the area, and had been forced to have the Gildanan men, Arganda included, draw some from memory. Arganda rode off, and Perrin moved to the front of the column. Being in charge did have its nice moments. Up here, the smells of unwashed bodies and rotting mud weren't nearly so strong. Ahead, he could finally see the Johanna Road like a long strap of leather cutting through the highland plains, running in a northwestern direction. Perrin rode, lost in thought for a time. Eventually, they reached the roadway. The mud didn't look as bad on the road as it had in the meadows, though if it were like any other road Perrin had traveled on, It would have its mires and washed-out sections. As he reached it, he noticed Gaul approaching. The Aiel man had been off scouting ahead, and as Perrin's horse stepped up onto the road, he noticed that someone was riding behind Gaul up toward them. It was Fennel, one of the farriers that Perrin had sent ahead with Master Gil and the others. Perrin felt a wash of relief to see him, but it was followed by worry. Where were the others?
Lord Perrin,
the man said, riding up. Gaul stepped to the side. Fennel was a wide-shouldered man and carried a long-handled workman's axe strapped to his back. He smelled of relief.
Praise the light. I thought you'd never arrive here. Your man says the rescue worked.
It did, Fennel, Perrin said, frowning. Where are the others?
They went on ahead, my lord,
Fennel said, bowing from horseback.
I volunteered to stay behind for when you caught up. We needed to explain, you see.
Explain?
The rest turned toward Lugard, Fennel explained. Along the road.
What? Perrin said, frustrated.
I gave them orders to continue northward. My lord,
Fennel said, looking abashed.
We met travelers coming from that way. Said that mud made the roads to the north almost completely impassable for wagons or carts. Master Gil decided that heading to Camelin through Lugard would be the best way to follow your orders. Sorry, my lord. That's why one of us had to stay behind.
Light. No wonder the scouts hadn't found Gil and the others. They'd gone in the wrong direction. Well, after slogging through mud for weeks himself, sometimes having to stop and wait out storms, Perrin couldn't blame them for deciding to take the road. That didn't stop him from feeling frustrated.
How far behind are we? Perrin asked.
I've been here 5 days, my lord.
So Gil and the others had been slowed too. Well, that was something at least.
Go get yourself something to eat, Fennel, Perrin said, and thank you for staying behind to let me know what happened. It was a brave thing you did, waiting alone for so long.
Somebody had to do it, my lord.
He hesitated.
Most feared you hadn't... Well, that things had gone wrong, my lord. You see, we figured you'd be faster than us, since we had those carts. But from the look of things here, you decided to bring the entire town with you.
It wasn't far from the truth, unfortunately. He waved Fennel on.
I found him about an hour along the road, Gaul said softly. Beside a hill that would make for an excellent camp. Well watered, with a good view of the surrounding area.
Perrin nodded. They'd have to decide what to do. Wait until Grady and Niald could make large gateways, follow along after Master Gil and the others on foot, or send most people northward and send only a few toward Lugard. Regardless of the decision, it would be good to camp for the day and sort things through.
Pass the word to the others, if you will, Perrin said to Gaul. We'll hike down the road to the place you found, then discuss what to do next. And ask some of the maidens if they'll ride along the road in the other direction to make sure we're not going to be surprised by anyone moving up the road behind us.
Gaul nodded and moved off to pass the word. Perrin remained sitting atop Stair, thinking. He had half a mind to send Arganda and Alejandra off to the northwest right now, setting on a path to Jahanna. But the maidens had picked out some Shido scouts watching his army. Those were probably there to make sure Perrin wasn't a threat. But they made him uneasy. These were dangerous times. It was best to keep Alejandra and her people with him for now, both for her safety and his own, at least until Grady and Niald recovered. The snake bites from the bubble of evil had affected the two of them, and Masuri, the only one of the Aes Sedai who had been bitten, worse than the others. Still, Grady was starting to look hale again. Soon he'd be able to make a gateway large enough to move the army through. Then Perrin could send Alejandra and the Two Rivers men home. He himself could travel back to Rand, pretend to make up, most people would still think that he and Rand had parted ways angrily, and then finally be rid of Berylaine and her winged guard. Everything could go back to the way it should be.
Light send it all went that easily.
He shook his head, dispelling the swirling colors and visions that appeared to his eyes whenever he thought of Rand. Nearby, Berylaine and her force were marching out onto the road, looking very pleased to reach some solid footing. The beautiful dark-haired woman wore a fine green dress and a belt of fire drops. Her neckline was discomfortingly low. He'd started relying on her during Fael's absence, once she'd stopped treating him like a prize boar to be hunted and skinned. Fael was back now, and it appeared his truce with Berylaine was over. As usual, Anura rode near her, though she didn't spend the time chatting with Berylaine she once had. Perrin never had figured out why she'd been meeting with the Prophet. Probably never would, considering what had happened to Massima. A day out of Malden, Perrin's scouts had run across a group of corpses that had been killed by arrows and robbed of their shoes, belts, and any valuables. Though ravens had gotten the eyes, Perrin had smelled Massima's scent through the rot. The Prophet was dead, killed by bandits. Well, perhaps that was a fitting end for him, but Perrin still felt he'd failed. Rand had wanted Massima brought to him. The colors swirled again. Either way, it was time for Perrin to return to Rand. The colors swirled, showing Rand standing in front of a building with a burned front, staring westward. Perrin banished the image. His duty was done, the Prophet seen to, Alejandra's allegiance secure. Only Perrin felt as if something were still very wrong. He fingered the blacksmith's puzzle in his pocket. To understand something, you have to figure out its parts. He smelled Fael before she reached him, heard her horse on the soft earth. So, Gil turned toward Lugard? She asked, stopping beside him. He nodded. That may have been wise. Perhaps we should turn that way too. Were those more sellswords who joined us?
Yes.
We must have picked up 5,000 people these last few weeks, she said thoughtfully. Perhaps more. Odd, in this desolate landscape.
She was beautiful, with her raven hair and strong features, a good Saldaean nose set between two tilted eyes. She was dressed for riding in deep wine red. He loved her dearly, and praised the light that he'd gotten her back. Why did he feel so awkward around her now?
You're troubled, my husband, she noted.
She understood him so well, it was almost as if she could read sense. It seemed to be a thing of women, though. Berylaine could do it, too.
We've gathered too many people, he said with a grunt. I should start turning them away.
I suspect they'd find their way back to our force anyway.
Why should they? I could leave orders.
You can't give orders to the pattern itself, my husband.
She glanced over at the column of people as they moved onto the road.
What do?
He cut off, catching her meaning.
You think this is me? Being Tavirin?
Every stop along our trip you've gained more followers, Fael said. Despite our losses against the Aiel, we came out of Malden with a stronger force than when we started. Haven't you found it odd that so many of the former Gaishine are taking to Tam's training with weapons?
They were beaten down so long, Perrin said. They want to stop that from happening again.
And so Coopers learn the sword, Fael said, and find they have a talent for it. Masons, who never thought of fighting back against Shido, now train with the quarterstaff. Sellswords and armsmen flock to us.
It's coincidence.
Coincidence? She sounded amused. With a Tavirin at the army's head?
She was right, and he fell silent. He could smell her satisfaction at winning the argument. He didn't think of it as an argument, but she'd see it as one. If anything, she'd be mad that he hadn't raised his voice.
This is all going to end in a few days, Fael, he said. Once we have gateways again, I'll send these people to their proper places. I'm not gathering an army. I'm helping some refugees to get home.
The last thing he needed was more people calling him my lord and bowing and scraping.
We shall see, she said.
Fail, he sighed and lowered his voice. A man's got to see a thing for what it is. No sense in calling a buckle a hinge or calling a nail a horseshoe. I've told you, I'm not a good leader. I proved that.
That's not how I see it.
He gripped the blacksmith's puzzle in his pocket. They'd discussed this during the weeks since Malden, but she refused to see sense.
The camp was a mess while you were gone, Fayil. I've told you how Arganda and the maidens nearly killed one another. And Aram? Masima corrupted him right under my nose. The Aes Sedai played at games I can't guess on the Two Rivers men? You see how they look at me with shame in their eyes.
Fail's scent spiked with anger when he said that, and she turned sharply toward Berylaine.
It's not her fault, Perrin said. If I'd been able to think of it, I'd have stopped the rumors dead. But I didn't. Now I've got to sleep in the bed I made for myself. Light. What does a man of his own neighbors don't think well of him? I'm no lord, Fail, and that's that. I've proven it soundly.
Odd, she said. But I've been speaking to the others, and they tell a different story. They say that you kept Arganda contained and put out flare-ups in the camp. Then there's the alliance with the Seanchan. The more I learn of that, the more impressed I am. You acted decisively in a time of great uncertainty. You focused everyone's efforts, and you accomplished the impossible in taking Malden. Those are the actions of a leader.
Fail,
he said, suppressing a growl.
Why wouldn't she listen? When she'd been a captive, nothing had mattered to him but recovering her.
Nothing.
It didn't matter who had needed his help or what orders he'd been given. Tarmangaiden itself could have started and he'd have ignored it in order to find Fail.
He recognized now how dangerous his actions had been. Trouble was, he'd take those same actions again. He didn't regret what he'd done, not for a moment. A leader couldn't be like that. He never should have let them raise that wolf head banner in the first place. Now that he'd completed his tasks, now that Fail was back, it was time to put all of that foolishness behind him. Perrin was a blacksmith. It didn't matter what Fail dressed him in or what titles people gave him. You couldn't make a draw knife into a horseshoe by painting it or by calling it something different. He turned to the side, where Jory Conger rode before the column, that blasted red wolfhead banner flapping proudly from a pole taller than a cavalryman's lance. Perrin opened his mouth to shout for him to take it down, but Fail spoke suddenly.
Yes, indeed, she said musingly. I've been thinking on this for the last few weeks, and, odd though it seems, I believe my captivity may have been precisely what we needed. Both of us.
What?
Perrin turned to her, smelling her thoughtfulness. She believed what she'd said.
Now, Fail said, we need to speak of...
Scouts returning, he said,
perhaps more abruptly than he intended.
Fail up ahead.
Fail glanced as he pointed, but of course she couldn't see anything yet. She knew of his eyes, though. She was one of the few who did. The call went up as others noticed the three figures in Cottonsore approaching alongside the road, the ones Perrin had sent to scout. Two maidens hurried for the wise ones, and one loped up to Perrin.
There is something beside the road, Perrin Ebarra, the woman said.
She smelled concerned. That was a dangerous sign.
It is something that you will wish to see.
Galad woke to the sound of a tent flap rustling. Sharp pains burned at his side where he had been repeatedly kicked. They matched the duller aches on his shoulder, left arm, and thigh, where he'd been wounded by Valda. His pounding headache was almost strong enough to drown out all else. He groaned, rolling onto his back. All was dark around him, but pinprick lights shone in the sky. Stars? It had been overcast for so long. No, something was wrong about them.
His head pulsed with pain, and he blinked tears from the corners of his eyes. Those stars looked so faint, so distant. They made no familiar patterns. Where could Asunawa have taken him that the very stars were different? As his mind cleared, he began to make out his surroundings. This was a heavy sleeping tent constructed to be dark during the daylight hours. The lights above weren't stars at all, but sunlight through the occasional pinholes of wear in the canvas. He was still naked, and with tentative fingers he determined that there was dried blood on his face. It had come from a long gash in his forehead. If he didn't wash it soon, infection was likely. He lay on his back, breathing in and out with care. If he took in too much air at once, his side screamed. Galad did not fear death or pain. He had made the right choices. It was unfortunate that he needed to leave the questioners in charge. They were controlled by the Shonchan. However, there had been no other option, not after he'd walked into Asanawa's hands. Galad felt no anger at the scouts who had betrayed him. The questioners were a valid source of authority in the children, and their lies had no doubt been convincing. No, the one he was angry at was Asunawa, who took what was true and muddied it. There were many who did that in the world, but the children should be different. Soon the questioners would come for him, and then the true price for saving his men would be exacted with their hooks and knives. He had been aware of that price when he'd made his decision. In a way, he had won, for he had manipulated the situation best. The other way to ensure his victory was to hold to the truth under their questioning, to deny being a dark friend with his final breath. It would be difficult, but it would be right. He forced himself to sit up, expecting and weathering the dizziness and nausea. He felt around. His legs were chained together, and that chain was locked to a spike that had been driven deep into the earth, piercing the rough canvas tent bottom. He tried yanking it free, just in case. He pulled so hard that his muscles failed him and he nearly passed out. Once he had recovered, he crawled to the side of the tent. His chains gave him enough room to reach the flaps. He took one of the cloth ties, used to hold the flaps up when they were opened, and spat on it. Then methodically, he wiped the grime and blood from his face. The cleaning gave him a goal, kept him moving, and stopped him from thinking about the pain. He carefully scrubbed the crusted blood from his cheek and nose. It was difficult. His mouth was dry. He bit down on his tongue to get saliva. The strips were not canvas, but a lighter material. They smelled of dust. He spat on a fresh section, then worked the spittle into the cloth. The wound to his head, the dirt on his face, these things were marks of victory for the questioners. He would not leave them. He would go into their tortures with a clean face. He heard shouts outside, men preparing to break down the camp. Would that delay their questioning? He doubted it. Striking camp could take hours. Galad continued cleaning, soiling the lengths of both straps, using the work as a kind of ritual, a rhythmic pattern to give him a focus for meditation. His headache withdrew, the pains of his body becoming less significant. He would not run. Even if he could escape, fleeing would invalidate his bargain with Asunawa. But he would face his enemies with self-respect. As he finished, he heard voices outside the tent. They were coming for him. He scrabbled quietly back to the stake in the ground. Taking a deep breath, despite the pain, he rolled onto his knees. Then he took the top of the iron spike in his left hand and pushed, heaving himself to his feet. He wobbled, then steadied himself, standing up all the way. His pains were nothing now. He had felt insect bites that were worse. He put his feet wide in a warrior's stance, his hands held before himself with his wrists crossed. He opened his eyes, back straight, staring at the tent flaps. It wasn't the cloak, the uniform, the heraldry, or the sword that made a man. It was the way he held himself. The flaps rustled,
then drew open. The outside light was brilliant to Galad's eyes, but he did not blink. He did not flinch. Silhouettes moved against an overcast sky. They hesitated, backlit. He could tell they were surprised to see him standing there.
Light, one exclaimed. Damodred, how is it that you're awake?
Unexpectedly, the voice was familiar.
Trom?
Galad asked, his voice ragged. Men spilled into the room. As his eyes adjusted, Galad made out Stocky Trom, along with Bornhald and Biar. Trom fumbled with a set of keys.
Stop, Galad said. I gave orders to you three. Bornhald, there is blood on your cloak. I commanded you not to try to free me.
Your men obeyed your orders, Damodred, a new voice said.
Galad looked up to see three men entering the room. Lord Berab Golliver, tall and bearded. Lord Alabar Harnesh, his bald, shadowed head missing its left ear. Lord Brandel Vordarian, a blonde hulk of a man from Galad's native Andor. All three lords captain of a legion, all three men who had stood with Asunawa.
What is this?
Galad asked them. Harnesh opened a sack and dumped something bulbous to the ground in front of Galad. A head. Asunawa's. All three men drew swords and knelt before him, the points of their weapons stabbing the canvas. Trom unlocked the manacles at Galad's feet.
I see, Galad said. You have turned your swords on fellow children. What would you have had us do?
Brandel asked, looking up from his kneeling position. Galad shook his head.
I do not know. Perhaps you are right. I should not chide you on this choice. It may have been the only one you could have made. But why did you change your minds?
We have lost two lords captain commander in under half a year,
Arnish said in a gruff voice.
The Fortress of the Light has become a playground for the Shan-Chan. The world is in chaos.
And yet, Gulliver said, Asunawa marched us all the way out here to have us battle our fellow children. It was not right, Damodred. We all saw how you presented yourself. We all saw how you stopped us from killing one another. Faced with that, and with the High Inquisitor naming as a dark friend a man we all know to be honorable, well, how could we not turn against him?
Galad nodded.
You accept me as Lord Captain Commander?
The three men bowed their heads.
All the Lords Captain are for you, Gulliver said. We were forced to kill a third of those who wore the Red Shepherd's crook of the Hand of the Light. Some others united with us. Some tried to flee. The Amadisians did not interfere, and many have said they'd rather join with us than return to the Shan-Chan. We have the other Amadisians, and the questioners who tried to run held at sword point.
Let free those who wish to leave, Galad said. They may return to their families and their masters. By the time they reach the Shan-Chan, we will be beyond their grasp.
The men nodded.
I accept your allegiance, Galad said. Gather the other lords captain and fetch me supply reports. Strike camp. We march for Andor.
None of them asked whether he needed rest, though Trom did look worried. Galad accepted the white robe a child brought into him, and then sat in a proffered chair as another, Child Candiar, a man expert in wounds, entered to inspect his injuries. Galad didn't feel wise or strong enough to bear the title he did, but the children had made their decision. The light would protect them for it.